Hello, friends, family, and all you sweaty scientists out there. Thanks for tuning in again to Knowing Stuff is Tight. Today we're talking about inadvertent climate modification, also known as climate change. Now, when talking about a complex subject like climate change, I think one of the most important things to recognize first is that everyone is at a different level of understanding. It takes a lot of care and thoughtfulness to adapt information in a way to reach a listener at their level, given the listener is willing to be wrong and learn something new. At the tail end of the year 2021, I believe one of the most important things for everyone to recognize is the importance of knowing how to determine what is real. There are a lot of liars out there, and the world is getting increasingly more complex. So with that said, I want my podcast to be something approachable to people at the beginning or medium stages of understanding. And I feel it's important to establish just two simple rules here. So rule number one is that we agree reality is best observed using our senses of sight, smell, taste, touch, and hearing, aka the scientific method. Rule number two is to give more attention to the experts who are constantly trying to prove themselves wrong instead of those who are trying to prove themselves right. I'm going to say that again. We should agree to give more attention to experts who are constantly trying to prove themselves wrong instead of those trying to prove themselves right. With that said, I want to say that I have clearly been wrong in the past. I'm currently wrong about a lot of things, and I will probably be wrong about many things in the future. The thing is, I don't really care if I'm wrong. My ego cares. And my ego, frankly, can kick rocks. You know what? Hey, ego!
Yeah?
Hey, get the f*** out of here!
Yeah, okay.
Oh, that guy, I swear. Okay, man, I can think so much more clearly now. All right, where was I? Right, now, there are a lot of people out there that like money and fame more than knowledge. And I want to implore my audience to please pay less attention to these types of people. Maybe you're already doing that. Great. Just be sure to check the receipts of any media outlet from which you consume information. And with that, let's jump right in. How can we know if climate change is real? So recently, my 7-year-old daughter asked me in the car, "When is the coronavirus going to be off?" I thought this was a pretty good teaching opportunity for me. So I told her the best that we can do is listen and pay attention to people that have spent a lot of time researching viruses and then think about what they have to say. I then used the example of learning how to read. So I said, "Do you remember when you used to not know how to read? You saw these symbols that didn't make any sense. But then somebody taught you how to read, and it opened up this entire new world to you, right?" I said, "If you wanted to know what something said in a book, would you ask somebody who didn't know how to read?" Of course you wouldn't. So I told her there are people that spend 10 or more years of their life just learning about how to read viruses. I told her we should listen to those people first and only then think about it for ourselves. Some people do the opposite, where they decide what's real first, and then they work their way back. I told her, we don't do that. So I believe this same method should be used to try and understand the climate. A scientifically illiterate person can look outside and decide for themselves if the climate is changing rapidly and dangerously, and if it's a big deal or not. But I think the person that does that on their own will probably have unreliable results, to say the least. It's also important to understand the role that money and the economy play and what information is most readily accessible to us through mainstream media outlets. So there's a quote I like from Upton Sinclair. He was an American novelist from the late 1800s, and he said, quote, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it." All right, I don't want to spend much more time on the virtues of critical thinking here, because that concept alone could be its own episode. If you consider yourself a climate skeptic, but still have an open mind, I recommend the website skepticalscience.com. It includes a ton of easy-to-read information about the most common climate change myths, and it even has a cranky uncle simulator. It's awesome. So what do the people who know how to read the climate and have minimal financial incentive to support one policy over the other have to say about climate change? Start, let's jump back 200 years to the 1820s. Mathematician and physicist Joseph Fourier first proposed the idea of a greenhouse effect. Simply put, the greenhouse effect states that heat radiating from the sun bounces off the Earth's surface and is kept in by certain gases in the atmosphere. In 1856, scientist Eunice Newton Foote showed that this warming effect was more pronounced with carbon dioxide, or CO2. In 1859, John Tyndall proposed that concentrations of methane and CO2 may have caused dramatic climate shifts in the past, resulting in the ice ages. In 1938, Guy Stewart Callender developed the theory that CO2 levels rose in tandem with the temperature of the climate. In the 1950s, Hans Sweis, Roger Revelle, and Charles Keeling began to record continuing temperature increase and termed their method the Keeling curve. Finally, in 1988, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, we're going to be talking about them a lot, was created to provide advice and warning to the world's governments and to increase funding for climate research. So now that we know a very simplified history of the research of climate change, I want to reference a peer-reviewed article from Cornell University.
You ever heard of it?
That was published on October 19th, 2021. So that is hot off the press at the time of this recording. The title of this article is the following: Greater than 99% consensus on human-caused climate change in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. I want to provide you some selections from both the summary or abstract and the conclusion of this article. I'll also provide a link to the article in the show notes. It says the following: while controls over the Earth's climate system have undergone rigorous hypothesis testing since the 1800s, questions over the scientific consensus of the role of human activities in modern climate change continue to arise in public settings. We update previous efforts to quantify the scientific consensus on climate change by searching the recent literature for papers skeptical of human-caused global warming. From a data set of over 88,000 climate-related papers published since 2012, we found 28 papers that were implicitly or explicitly skeptical. We conclude with high statistical confidence that the scientific consensus on human-caused contemporary climate change expressed as a proportion of the total publications, exceeds 99% in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. Our results confirm, as has been found in numerous other previous studies of this question, that there is no significant scientific debate among experts about whether or not climate change is human-caused. This issue has been comprehensively settled, and the reality of human-caused climate change is no more in contention among scientists than is plate tectonics or evolution. The tiny number of papers that have been published during our time period which disagree with this overwhelming scientific consensus have had no discernible impact, presumably because they do not provide any convincing evidence to refute the hypothesis that it is extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century, and it is unequivocal that human influence has warmed the atmosphere, ocean, and land. Our finding is that the broadly defined scientific consensus likely far exceeds 99% regarding the role of human-caused greenhouse gas emissions in modern climate change, and may even be as high as 99.9%. Of course, the prevalence of myths and disinformation about the role of greenhouse gas emissions in modern climate change is unlikely to be driven purely by genuine scientific illiteracy or lack of understanding. Even so, in our view, it remains important to continue to inform society on the state of the evidence. According to the most recent IPCC summary and many other previous studies, mitigating future warming requires urgent efforts to eliminate fossil fuels combustion and other major sources of man-made greenhouse gas emissions. Our study helps confirm that there is no remaining scientific uncertainty about the urgency and gravity of this task. Okay, hang on. I've just been told that we have live footage of a dead horse over here.
It's all just an act.
Stop! He's already dead.
So if the scientific community overwhelmingly agrees that climate change is real and is man-made, why does it remain such a controversial topic? After just a little bit of study, you'll find that climate change controversy is mostly only a thing in the United States. Well, we debate here whether it's real, time-sensitive, or man-made. Most other developed countries instead debate which policies will be most effective in mitigating climate change. Turns out here is a small group of very well-funded and loud bad actors, mostly made up of fossil fuel lobbies, conservative think tanks, and contrarian scientists. The fossil fuel lobby has made every attempt to muddy the waters and cast confusion and doubt about climate science where there simply is none. In fact, in the 1980s, ExxonMobil funded academic research on climate change. Here's an excerpt from an article written for the LA Times in 2015. Quote, Duane Levine, Exxon's manager of science and strategy development, gave a primer to the company's board of directors in 1989, noting that scientists generally agreed gases released by burning fossil fuels could raise global temperatures significantly by the middle of the 21st century, causing glaciers to melt and sea levels to rise, with generally negative consequences. But he also made it clear that the company was facing another threat as well from public policymakers. This phenomenon holds many similarities to the way the tobacco industry cast doubt on the health effects of cigarette smoking in the 1950s. No intellectually honest person today holds the view that cigarettes do not pose serious health risks. I highly recommend a book and subsequent documentary entitled Merchants of Doubt: How a Handful of Scientists Obscured the Truth on Issues from Tobacco Smoke to Global Warming. In it, the authors identify the similarities between the propaganda campaigns of the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel lobbies in order to maximize profits. This is actually free online. I'll post a link to the documentary in the show notes. Now, it wasn't until the 1980s that climate change really had the public's attention. At the time, though, media coverage was hit or miss. It was mostly poorly executed because it mixed together problems with the ozone layer with those of the climate change. Later in 2004, the movie The Day After Tomorrow sparked conversation about catastrophic climate change.
Mr. Vice President,
too late.
I'm afraid that time has come and gone, my friend.
What can we do?
Save as many as you can.
And then a few years later, Al Gore released his documentary, An Inconvenient Truth.
I am Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America.
While I see Al Gore as your typical, mostly disingenuous and out-of-touch politician, I still recommend watching the documentary. It's very well produced, and the information presented is scientifically based. So don't shoot the messenger, as they say. According to a Pew Research poll in April 2020, public opinion in the U.S. had shifted dramatically in the last decade. In 2009, 44% of adults agreed climate change was a major threat to the well-being of the United States. That number rose to 60% in 2020. Most of that shift was from Democrat or leaning Democrat voters, with 88% in that category agreeing that climate change was a major threat. The general opinion of Republican voters is that, quote, environmental laws cost too many jobs and hurt the economy. Another Pew Research study from 2015 showed that more highly educated people, women, and younger people were more likely to see climate change as a threat. Countries with higher greenhouse gas emissions were concerned less with the effects of climate change than countries with fewer emissions. A majority of citizens worldwide, though, express a high level of worry about climate change. Since the Industrial Revolution, the burning of coal, oil, and natural gas has greatly contributed to the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. But those are not the only contributors. I want to discuss the greenhouse gases and the other culprits a little more in detail here. So according to the IPCC, in 2019, the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere had increased by 48% since 1750, and methane had increased by 160% in the same time frame. This level of CO2 is the greatest it has been in any time in the last 2 million years. Yikes. As of 2018, 34% of the land surface is used for agriculture, 26% forests, and 30% is infertile, so glaciers and deserts, etc. Forests continue to be converted to farmland, and this has greatly contributed to global warming. One of the reasons for this is that vegetation in forests act as a carbon sink, so they absorb a significant amount of CO2, so fewer forests equals more CO2 staying in the atmosphere. The conversion of dark forests to lighter grasslands or farmlands can also result in greater amounts of reflected sunlight. It's also been hypothesized that solar flares or variations in energy output from the sun has been one of the causes for increased global temperatures. Solar activity has actually been measured since the early 1600s, and there has been no upward trend in the sun's energy reaching the Earth. Volcanic eruptions have also been considered as main contributors to CO2 emissions that lead to global warming. Present-day volcanic CO2 emissions make up the same amount as less than 1% of current man-made CO2 emissions. Now, climate scientists warn us of the many environmental impacts caused by climate change. These include things like droughts, heat waves, extreme wet or dry seasons, rate of rainfall, intensity of hurricanes, melting of glaciers and Arctic sea ice, sea level rise, ocean acidification, and lower oxygen levels in the ocean. Since the 1950s, most of those items on the list have appeared with increasing frequency as well. Now, you may have heard of tipping points or points of no return in regards to the effects of climate change.
We're like, the world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change.
To avert the worst consequences of climate crisis, we have 9 years left.
We're going to pass the point of no return within the next 8 to 10 years.
I'll give a few examples here of what climate scientists tell us are likely points of no return. The main one is the melting of the West Antarctic and Greenland ice sheet. Once that ice melts, it will not re-solidify while global temperature remains above a 1.5 to 2 degrees Celsius threshold. The melting of these ice sheets would result in a global sea level rise of about 65 meters, or 70 yards, if you're American. Obviously, this will have the most serious effects on coastal cities and small islands. Warming has also caused many species of animals to move toward the poles and towards higher elevations. The speed at which this is occurring will make abrupt changes to the ecosystem and will likely lead to the extinction of many species. Ocean acidification has already negatively affected sea life, and heat waves have resulted in the bleaching of coral reefs as well. As for the humans, the effects of climate change are going to be felt most by those in developing countries. The World Health Organization has declared human impacts from climate change as the greatest threat to global health in the 21st century. So here is the doom list: crop failure, easier transmission of infectious diseases like dengue fever and malaria, coastal flooding, lower quality of air and water, and fewer fish to catch. It is predicted that crop production will be negatively affected mostly below the equator, while higher up in latitude, the effects on crops could be positive or negative. Regions that depend on glacier water, dry areas, and small islands are at the greatest risk of water shortage. Regarding economic damages, it's predicted that increased global warming will also lead to an increase in global income inequality. The most impoverished areas of the world, like sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia, will be hit the hardest. Island nations like the Maldives will likely be uninhabitable, and in some regions near the equator, temperatures will be too high for people to tolerate. It's predicted that we'll see a mass migration of climate refugees in greater numbers than ever before.
You're probably wondering why your ice cream went away. Well, Susie, the culprit isn't foreigners, it's global warming.
Global wapu?
Yeah. Meet Mr. Sunbeam. He comes all the way from the sun to visit Earth.
Hello, Earth. Just popping in to brighten your day. La 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 la. And now, I'll be on my way.
Not so fast, Sunbeam. We're greenhouse gases. You ain't going nowhere.
Oh! Ah! Oh! Ah! Oh! Oh, God, it hurts!
Pretty soon, Earth is chock full of sunbeams. They're rotting corpses heating our atmosphere.
How do we get rid of the greenhouse gases?
Fortunately, our handsomest politicians came up with a cheap, last-minute way to combat global warming. Ever since 2063, we simply drop a giant ice cube into the ocean every now and then.
Just like Daddy puts in his drink every morning. And then he gets mad.
Of course, since the greenhouse gases are still building up, it takes more and more ice each time. Thus, solving the problem once and for all.
But
once and for all!
Now, I don't want to just pile on to the despair and hopelessness that seems so prevalent in the news. I want to be more optimistic and solutions-focused. So, let's talk about some solutions being implemented to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and mitigate the... Who left the door open to the third world countries? How many times? Hang on.
Say, keep this shut. Dad,
Sorry about that. What was I saying? Okay, yeah. In 2015, an agreement was negotiated at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in France, also known as the Paris Agreement. This agreement set a long-term temperature goal of keeping the global temperatures below 2 degrees Celsius by 2050. It was negotiated by nearly 200 different countries. The effects of climate change can be mitigated in several different ways. Two of the main ways are the reduction of greenhouse gas emissions and the implementation of carbon sinks. Again, a carbon sink is any type of reservoir that absorbs and removes carbon from the atmosphere, like forests and the ocean. There is also technology to create artificial carbon sinks that can suck the carbon out of the air. It is a relatively new technology, and it's yet to be seen how impactful that's going to be. In 2018, 80% of the world's energy was provided by fossil fuels. In order of most used resource, they are the following: oil at number one, and coal, and natural gas. The remaining 20% of the entire world's energy, in order of most used, is hydropower, nuclear, and then a mix of wind, solar, bioenergy, which is a fancy name for burning wood, and then, in last place, geothermal. Now, to even come close to the goal of reducing temperature rise by 2 degrees Celsius by 2050, those percentages need to be flipped. Now, the good news is in 2019, 75% of all new electricity generation installed was renewable, and this was mostly solar and wind. There is no silver bullet for clean energy production, but a mix of technologies can provide enough energy for everyone in a carbon-neutral way. It is possible. And believe it or not, we can even do this without a serious reduction in quality of life. So let's start with the wind and solar. Some of the challenges with wind and solar include variability in the weather and the seasons. So the sun ain't always shining, and the wind ain't always blowing. So the idea is that you store the energy in a battery for the times where the weather is not activating the solar panels or the wind turbines. The problem is battery storage technology isn't quite where it needs to be to store all of the power generated by wind and solar. Not to mention the amount of land needed for solar and wind farms. So in short, wind and solar are decent alternative power sources, but the technology is not quite available to even come close to matching fossil fuel-powered plants' energy output in time to meet the UN's goal. Enter nuclear power.
Nuclear missile ready.
Now, in my research for this episode, one of the most surprising things I came across was the amount of misinformation regarding the dangers of nuclear power. While nuclear may appear to be a scary and dangerous source of energy, no doubt because of the horrors of Chernobyl and Fukushima, when you look at the numbers, it's actually one of the safest, most cost-efficient forms of energy we know of. Not to mention the waste generated by nuclear plants is far less harmful than that of fossil fuels. Now, when we simply look at energy created and compare that with deaths caused by energy source, the numbers between nuclear and fossil fuels can be pretty shocking. Without getting too technical here, for each terawatt hour of energy, that's a lot, each terawatt hour of energy produced, we've recorded about 100,000 deaths caused by fossil fuels, while a mere 90 deaths can be attributed to nuclear. Now, one of the drawbacks of nuclear, though, is that it is incredibly expensive to build. It's around $6 to $9 billion for each nuclear power plant. It can also take around 10 years to finish the construction. Now, I could go on for a while about the merits of nuclear power, but instead I'll provide links in the show notes for a few very easy to understand videos on YouTube that can explain the ins and outs of nuclear more in depth. Now, it's also necessary to improve agriculture practices to make them more sustainable as well. The way we farm in the US and in most parts of the world is simply not sustainable. The popular US diet is also extremely costly to the environment. One example to consider is the amount of water required to produce a single pound of beef. It's 1,800 gallons. 1,800 gallons. According to the USDA, Americans eat around 50 billion hamburgers per year. Take that number with a grain of salt. It's about 2 hamburgers per day, per person. Now, I'm not going to get up on my soapbox and preach vegetarianism, but if the average American reduced their meat intake by one meal per week, that could literally save millions of gallons of water each year. Like I said earlier, we don't have to make a huge lifestyle change to make a pretty significant impact. Now, carbon capture and storage is another technique that collects the CO2 emitted and stores it back underground. Like I mentioned earlier, this is new technology, but it is being continually developed to mitigate the amount of CO2 emitted by fossil fuels. The long-term effects of storing CO2 in the earth have also not been studied, so this method ranks pretty low in priority in climate change policy implementation. Rise in global temperature will mostly affect those in developing countries. These are the places in the world where manual labor outdoors is most prevalent, and a rise in temperature will increase the amount of heat stroke and heat fatigue. Developing countries also simply cannot afford air conditioning to combat these higher temperatures indoors, and even if they could afford them, it would require, you know, more energy. So investment in education and early warning systems can certainly help these types of communities in the short term, but it is likely that the areas experiencing the greatest rises in temperature and sea level will be forced to migrate.
I was watching my TV one night when they broke in with a special report about some devastating earthquake in Peru. There were 30,000 crushed to death, even more were buried alive. On the Richter scale, it measured 8.2. And I said, God, please answer me one question. Why'd they have to interrupt the Simpsons just for this? What a drag, 'cause I was taping it and everything. And now I'll have to wait for the rerun to see the part of the show I missed.
The countries that are most vulnerable to rising global temperatures are generally the ones least responsible for greenhouse gas emissions. No fair. The opposite is true, in that the countries most responsible for emissions are the ones least likely to be affected. What's difficult about implementing climate policy globally is something called the free rider problem. Try to use a simple example to explain this concept. So country A and country B are both wealthy countries with strong economies, both highly dependent on fossil fuels. If country A decides to minimize fossil fuel use and invest in renewables, That leaves country B open to capitalize on its fossil fuel trade. Since country A is no longer investing or purchasing fossil fuels, country B is open to make a ton of money. So, noble country A's economy suffers temporarily, while country B profits and continues to emit CO2. Eventually, country A decides it's not worth the cost, so it goes back to fossil fuels. So this is a very simplified example of generally what has been happening when the UN makes policy proposals in combating climate change globally. So now, I believe, is a good time to talk about who's emitting the most greenhouse gases. The real answer may surprise you. Research group Carbon Brief published an analysis in October 2021 detailing which countries are historically responsible for climate change. So they tracked and compiled CO2 emissions dating all the way back to 1850, so close to 200 years worth of data here. Counting down the top three, we have Russia in third place with 7% of total CO2 emissions. In second place, we have China with 11%. And for the number one spot, we have the one, the only, United States of America with 20% of the global total.
USA! 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 USA!
So now that we know who to properly blame and shame, let's talk about some policy options. So carbon pricing and carbon taxes are something that would artificially limit the amount any one country is allowed to emit per year. Also, a reduction in subsidies to the fossil fuel industry would make significant reductions in emissions as well. So just to give you an idea, in 2017, direct global fossil fuel subsidies totaled $319 billion. In 2016, in just the U.S., our government directed $4.6 billion to fossil fuel subsidies, but $11 billion towards renewable energy. So it's at least going in the right direction. Things like vehicle efficiency standards, renewable fuel standards, and air pollution regulations have also been implemented to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. It's also been proposed that wealthier countries that emit the majority of emissions should be held responsible in funding development in developing countries. Also, with the reduction of jobs in the fossil fuel industry, retraining would need to be funded to counteract employment loss. Well, there you have it. Now you have a basic understanding of climate change, global warming, inadvertent climate modification, or whatever you want to call it. Thanks again, as always, for listening. And to close out this episode, here are a few words from the great Carl Sagan.
And we have to bear in mind that in problems like this, the initial stages of global temperature increase, one region of the planet might benefit while another region of the planet suffers. And there has to be a kind of trading off of benefits and suffering. And that requires a degree of international amity which certainly doesn't exist today. I think that what is essential for this problem is a global consciousness, a view that transcends our exclusive identifications with the generational and political groupings into which by accident we have been born. The solution to these problems requires a perspective that embraces the planet and the future, because we are all in this greenhouse together. Thank you. We'll be right back.
of the friends and machines, and friends and ideas, and philosophy and spirit.